So a lot of 2020 has, as many people have observed, felt like a movie. Although I think now it feels a little bit more like a student film, like, you know, some second year student at USC film school. This is what he came up with. Doesn't really feel like a fully realized movie that you could, you know, distribute to theaters anymore. All right. I mean, it's just not coherent enough. Anyway, we are going to be talking about related subjects right now. We are fortunate to have back with us a guest that we're always excited to have. John Harris is the co-founder of Politico and the author of The Survivor, Bill Clinton in the White House. He writes Altitude, a weekly column for Politico. And, you know, I've been thinking today, this is sort of a meta question to set up, John. I've been thinking today about an essay from about 1980 by George W. S. Trow. It was called In the Context of No Context. It was published in book form. In the Context of No Context, it was actually about how we were becoming more ahistorical because of television, which was dividing us up and interfering with social coherence. And of course, we know that's all true. But I think now it feels as though we've been pulled like a piece of gum off the sole of history's shoe, and we're just floating in this space that's impossible to assess because it doesn't correspond to anything we know. We've got a president mismanaging a pandemic and then getting the disease a month before Election Day, a president who owes $420 million to God knows who, and who empowers and endorses extremist groups, a Senate trying to ram a Supreme Court nominee through 30 days before the election as some of its members of the Senate get the pandemic disease. And to top it all off, last night, the sick president stands unmasked on the balcony like Juan Perón. And it almost feels like the paradigm of even having somebody really smart and experienced like you, John Harris, having you come on the show and analyze this, it is almost increasingly defeated by the fact pattern. I mean, are you finding, this is the meta question, are you finding that what you know about the history and behavior of major public and political institutions is becoming less useful to you as this scenario changes into something that doesn't correspond to points of reference?
Yes, that's a big meta question that I thought about a lot, Colin, but it's got a short answer. Yes.
You call it a cosmic joke.
Times. And so our frames of reference about what happens normally, our belief that, well, this could never happen, mm-hmm. or here's what happens when such and such takes place. It's all been shredded over and over again, things that we would think could never happen. Have happened. They now seem to be happening with increasing velocity, and there's a tragic element to it, but it's infused with slapstick. I think that's your point about the film. So I agree. We've got something stuck on our shoe, Colin. I'm not sure it's gum.
Right. I mean, so much of analysis is sort of if A then B, but if A then B is usually kind of predicated on our prior understanding, you know, of what's happened in the past. We can detect patterns in public life and say, well, we know that typically if A happens, then B will be the probable result. But I feel like even that simple a paradigm seems a little defeated at the moment.
Well, the mind can go in one of two directions. It can go in a kind of a normalizing direction, trying to make sense of this based on rational understanding of what we think is happening, or it can go, as bluntly mine sometimes does, in some moods in kind of a mystical direction. It's almost as if the cosmos is toying with us, and it's making a mockery of that context that you mentioned, the way things are. That, you know, it turns out the gods have a sense of humor. I thought that as I pondered Trump's illness. You can't go very far as a journalist with mystical explanations, so let's get down to more secular ones. We are in an age where trust in institutions has been eroding. That long precedes President Trump. What Trump represents is the kind of final crumbling of a lot of precedents and norms and values that used to infuse institutions, politics, the news media, lots of other institutions, and kind of this is what happens when you shred the institutions that historically have been the rule book. You know, there was a certain understanding about the amount of information the media was entitled to have from a president when he was facing health problems. Like, well, you can shred that. There, you know, and we could talk all day about different examples of expectations and norms, precedents that have been shredded in the Trump years. Connecting all of them is the idea that a lot of Americans just don't have trust in the institutions that used to enforce those norms.
So let's try and if the A and then B out here in the non-meta real world. So typically, based on, I think, everything that we know, if we've been spending a lot of our lives looking at politics, if you could imagine, pre-imagine a situation where the president, who was kind of in trouble, or maybe a lot of trouble election-wise for having mismanaged a pandemic, got the disease, it would, so if that's A, B, a logical B would be that he would use that moment, assuming he recovered from the disease, to speak to a bunch of people who currently reject him, who feel as though he hasn't taken the pandemic seriously enough. They may have lost relatives or friends from the pandemic and feel as though his cavalier attitude and dismissive rhetoric is part of the problem. So he could use that moment to try to expand his base and talk in a much more humbled and sympathetic tone about this, and maybe even have a sort of an Ebenezer Scrooge on Christmas Day revelation. But that's not the B we're getting here, is it?
Well, look, Colin, that's your fantasy. It's never been Trump's fantasy. And, you know, you can play that game at almost any point in the plot line. A lot of people thought that might be that incarnation of Trump, more modest, more open to persuading people who disagree with him, thought that would take place after election or at the inaugural or at different points along the way. It seems to me he could have tried something like that at the beginning of the pandemic and said, hey, look, the old way I've been practicing my politics is no longer relevant to our new circumstances. And he could have done it. It would have been late in the day. Here we are in October, just a month away from the election, a little less than that. He could have done that with this most recent illness. But, you know, at some point you've got to surrender that fantasy. Trump believes in the brand of politics that's taken him this far. And he believes in the kind of personal style that's taken him this far in life. You know, to state the obvious, it's a politics of mobilization, getting people who share his grievances or identify with him personally kind of riled up and further committed to this notion of Trump as an invincible figure, an almost kind of supernatural force as a leader. It's a politics of mobilization. It's not a politics of persuasion. Like, look, hey, I know you have some misgivings about me, but let me tell you why I'm right and see if I can kind of bring you into the fold. Bill Clinton practiced politics of persuasion. Sometimes the liberals resented it. They wanted a more a kind of a fiercer, bolder brand of politics. For the past 20 years, our politics has had more mobilization. George W. Bush did that. Trump does that. Barack Obama was kind of a composite of the two. I think under other circumstances, he might have tried to be a persuasive politician. Maybe that just doesn't work in our modern politics. We're all about mobilizing people around their grievances.
You know, you mentioned Clinton. I've been thinking a lot about him lately, and also thinking very specifically about the famous moment in his debate with 41, where he, Bush 41 was sort of unable to respond to a woman asking a question, and Clinton said in a way that elicited chuckles from some people, but I think was very effective. He said, "I feel your pain." And who knows, because he was a man of many masks, who knows whether he felt her pain. But he understood at that moment that that was the human response. That was the thing that needed to be said. And that that was the thing that would separate him in a significant manner from the reserve and patrician well, reserve is really the perfect word, of George Bush 41. And, you know, it just kind of, that doesn't seem to be anywhere, as you're saying, in Trump's arsenal. It's a fantasy to suppose that it could exist anywhere there. But isn't it just a gigantic political mistake not to somehow or other humanize this moment?
You know, I've thought about it so often, Colin, in that, I wrote a column, I guess a year or so ago, like, what if Trump weren't nuts? It was kind of a provocative headline.
I remember that one.
What if he was the kind of a practice a more rational brand of politics, projected that kind of empathy or curiosity that you're describing and that Bill Clinton was good at? What if he recalibrated? You know, I think, to be honest, he would be in formidable position. He could have really been a decisive president. He clearly was right about the mood of the country, or significant portion of the country, on some big issues, trade, more confrontational stance toward China. That's really now mainstream thinking in both parties in a way that it wasn't. And so you could envision a different kind of presidency and a different role in history for President Trump. But in order to do so, you would have to also envision a completely different character. And with a completely different character, there probably wouldn't have been a Trump presidency in the first place. You can play this game endlessly. What if Nixon had all his mastery of politics and the global stage, but he didn't have this paranoid streak? Imagine that. Like, well, what if he probably wouldn't have been president without that kind of inner darker side to his character? What if Bill Clinton had been everything he was, but you could separate the sexual indiscretion? Well, that itself flowed from a kind of a neediness and a drive to please and an instinct to always put himself at the center of things. That without that, he probably would never have been president in the first place. So it's fun parlor game to play these what ifs.
Right, almost invariably, John, I think a leader's virtues are also his vices. And you just simply have to hope. I mean, in the case of Obama, he also had a kind of reserve and a kind of no drama quality, which was very effective and really helped him a lot, except at times where maybe he needed to connect in a little bit more emotional or human way. So everybody's got that, you know. I know that one thing that you're struggling with right now, and struggling with it in print, so to speak, is the question of how do we react to this particular moment, to the fairly serious, we don't know how serious because we can't get any really straight information, but fairly serious illness of a president, which seems to be conducted like everything else with a tremendous amount of theatricality and not a lot of substantive information. But there's, you know, Michelle Obama said, when they go low, we go high, which is a great slogan and it's great advice. It's harder.
Work. Yeah. Maybe over the long term it works. Doesn't work in every individual.
You were writing, it feels hard to go high, or at least all the way high here when dealing with Trump and his illness.
Well, I think the original headline of that column you referenced, Colin, was called, "Is it okay to laugh at Trump's coronavirus?" And then some colleagues in the newsroom thought that sounded a little insensitive, so we went to some other slightly more opaque headline. But the question is, you know, it was a real one. I heard from tons of people. I wasn't up when the news first broke at around 1 a.m. Eastern, but by the time I was up around 6:30, of course, my phone was exploding with texts and emails. And, you know, a lot of people, you know, to put it bluntly, were kind of buzzing on the news. They did think there was something funny about it, or at a minimum, they thought there was a kind of a karmic justice to it. Of course, a lot of people didn't believe it. What's the catch? I wonder if this is really happening. So is it okay to laugh? I don't think, first off, we're not that far gone as individuals that we should be laughing at anybody's illness or gloating about it. That's different, though, than saying than acknowledging the simple truth, which is President Trump, through his own behavior, did invite some of this. He put himself at higher risk And I don't think we have to treat it with the sort of grave solemnity, which we might if it was, if the circumstances were different. President Trump, by his own behavior, hasn't really invited that degree of sympathy or even empathy. If he doesn't extend it, he's not likely to get it back from a lot of people. So, I think one of the most notorious quotes ever was Malcolm X talking about the JFK assassination. He said it was a case of chickens coming home to roost. That is, America was with its culture of violence. This was the natural extension of that, that violence would take its own leader. And then I think Reverend Jeremiah Wright, President Obama's former pastor, used it in what a lot of people thought was a really outrageous way. I guess I similarly thought it was outrageous after 9/11, the chickens coming home to roost. But I think in both cases they meant, look, there's a kind of a cosmic justice that works in the world. And in this case, to me, it's not even a hard one to say that this is chickens coming home to roost for President Trump, both in the kind of literal sense. That is, he engaged in high risk behavior. And so it's not unexpected that he might get this. And I think in the more mystical sense, which is, somebody that mocks other people for wearing masks, that mocked Hillary Clinton when she got sick in the 2016 campaign. There is a little bit of karmic justice that when somebody who does that himself is laid low. It's not a question of gloating to say the chickens are coming home to roost. It's just a fair observation.
All right. We're talking to John Harris, co-founder of Politico. We're going to take a little break. We're going to come back with a little bit more of John. Every cop is a criminal, and all the sinners saints. This head is tail, just call me Lucifer. You're listening to the Colin McEnroe Show. We're talking to John Harris, the co-founder of Politico, the author of The Survivor, Bill Clinton in the White House. He writes Altitude. I don't know why I keep wanting to call it The Altitude. He writes Altitude, a weekly column for Politico. So just to sort of build on this, one of the things that I've been thinking a lot about, partly, John, because a woman who is a kind of an activist in a small town in Connecticut recently died. She'd been on our show. She got in a lot of trouble because in a sort of Kaepernickian fashion, she at town board meetings would kneel during the Pledge of Allegiance, I think. She got death threats. She got men writing to her to threaten her with sexual violence and then punctuating that with MAGA, at the end. And there was this bitter irony of the fact that, their big complaint with her was the kind of disruption of patriotic decorum. And then they're threatening her life and threatening her with rape. But one of the things that I think has changed is you pay a very, very high price these days, whether you're a journalist, a whistleblower, a citizen with a conscience, if you go against whatever the Trump tide is. I feel like that price is higher than it's been in my lifetime.
There's been a lot of really ugly behavior in American life in recent years. I agree with that. I think that one side is more responsible for that ugliness, but I don't think they're uniformly responsible. Threatening somebody is the woman you mentioned, who's been the guest on your show, in that fashion for expressing her views. No reason to mince words. That is un-American. That runs counter to American tradition. And her kneeling, at least as I imagine it, and as I observe it in other people like Colin Kaepernick, it's not a way of showing disrespect for America. It's a way of showing contempt for the gap between American ideals and American practice. And so in that sense, it's an expression of patriotism, not a defiance of patriotism.
The I agree, first of all, that there is some blame to lay on both sides for the current state of polarization.
And I don't mean to get into both sidisms, no. But it's because that's not how I feel. But
I also feel so. I've been listening lately to this terrific BBC podcast that's about the bombing of the Murrah Building in Oklahoma City. It's called something like two minutes past nine is what it's called. So one of the things they sort of document here is the way that that kind of extremism that was expressed in the form of Timothy McVeigh or some of the right wing extremist groups that preceded him is now being manifested, you know, not only in a president who seems unable to denounce, say, the Proud Boys or the white supremacist at Charlottesville. But, you know, I mean, you can even see it a little bit in the kind of anti-government rhetoric of people resisting COVID protections, that there's a way in which, you know, it seems to be bleeding, not maybe into the mainstream exactly, but with a president who won't draw a line anywhere, it does seem as though that kind of attitude has more room to grow and flourish.
Certainly more visible, Colin. I agree with you on that. I don't necessarily agree that it's flourishing. I certainly hope not. My own view is that brand of politics represents kind of the last spasms of a dying old order. The nationalist movements, whether in the United States, as personified by Trump, or in European countries where we've seen kind of a similar brand of politics, as I observe it, it's the appeal is primarily to an older, whiter, and more culturally traditional and therefore culturally threatened or people that feel threatened and vulnerable in some way. So these movements, older, whiter, more traditional, are taking place in an electorate that's becoming younger, more diverse, more cosmopolitan and culturally tolerant. And so I don't see them as ascendant. I actually see them as declining, and some of the most flamboyant behavior is, I think, is a symptom of that decline.
So that sounds like maybe you're a little bit hopeful for the post-Trump future, because, I mean, I think I know it's a question you've written about, and it's a question, you know, during the debate last week, at least a lot of us could say, well, that's not a debate. That's not the way that's supposed to be. So our norms weren't so completely degraded and forgotten that we couldn't recognize something really abnormal. But it's an interesting question. Assuming Biden is victorious, you know, what parts of our national public life are repairable and which ones aren't?
That is a great question. The great historian, Arthur Schlesinger Jr., who for all I know was on your show. He died, I think, in 2007. He'd certainly be familiar to many of your listeners. He said the great strength of democracy is its capacity for self-correction. And we should all hope that's true. And I think it is true. The question of norms and how do you restore them once shattered is a really good one. You and I could recognize that debate as not normal, as an embarrassment. What about my children? They're young adults, and I don't think they have a frame of reference to earlier debates. They don't remember the Reagan era or the Clinton era debates, or even the Bush Obama era debates. That's their normal. Trump era politics is their normal. They recognize it as in some way distorted and defective. That's not what they wish for their country. But they don't have the same sense that you or I have, which is, wait a minute, that just doesn't happen. They know it does happen.
Yeah. So we only got a couple of minutes left, but I would assume that your young adult children and a lot of young adult children. I mean, when you look at the tremendous response in 2016 to Bernie Sanders, well, what was that all about? That was about a lot of young people suddenly going, wow, hold on. Here is somebody with a message and the content of it is discernible and he seems to really mean it. And he's articulating a vision of what government can do that I'm not really hearing anywhere else. I'm getting really excited. to me, that generation of young adults, maybe because they don't have our jaded presuppositions, may be able to embrace better ideals than we post-Trump.
I think that's right. There's certainly an impatience, and there's certainly an expanded sense of what's possible. I do think the that's one thing Trump has done in one direction. Voices like Bernie Sanders are doing in a different direction. They've broadened the lines of politics and of what's sort of what's possible. You know, if we were to go back 20 years ago, you'd say, well, wait a minute, somebody who's a self-described socialist, that person has no role in presidential politics. That's nothing's going to happen with that. And we wouldn't have been able to foresee the impact that not just Bernie Sanders has, Elizabeth Warren has, and other candidates have in sort of moving beyond the Clinton era politics of the 90s, or even the Barack Obama politics of, just ended a half decade ago. The boundaries change, and they're constantly changing. That's why politics is interesting to cover.
Well, on that note, yes, interesting. Interesting is, yes, and you're absolutely right, John Harris. We've discovered that a lot of things are possible that we didn't think were possible. Some of those things have been horrific, but some of those things—
But they're not all bad.
They're not all bad. No, there's some of them are really quite hopeful. John Harris is co-founder of Politico and the author of The Survivor, Bill Clinton in the White House. He writes Altitude, a weekly column for Politico. Thank you for spending time with us today.
Thanks, Colin. I hope we can do it again soon.
Oh, yeah.
Sense of our country. It's time at the top. Couldn't be coming to an end.
Hey, we're back. I hope you did pledge. And if you didn't pledge just now, you should listen to this segment because it's going to be really good. But then at the end of that, you should definitely pledge. And there'll be somebody coming on for the last 5 minutes of this hour to get you to do that. Meanwhile, I got to thank Kat Pastor. She's in the studio making it possible for me to work remotely and also making it possible for Betsy Kaplan, senior producer of the Colin McEnroe Show and producer of this particular episode, also to work remotely. We've got some other exciting shows coming up later this week, but my thoughts aren't well enough organized to talk about them right now. And anyway, I want to talk to Peter Walker, who leads the White House COVID Tracker, a crowdsourced database for the White House COVID outbreak and head of growth at Public Relay. Peter Walker, thanks for joining us.
Hey, Colin. Good to be here.
So maybe just begin with, like, I think some people, well, first of all, explain what the tracker is. Explain what it is you're doing.
Sure thing. So Benji Renton, Dr. Jesse O'Shea, and I put together this tracker to keep sort of a handle on all of the public reporting that's going on around who has been involved in this White House outbreak. So we're tracking about 290 contacts now from five or six different events that the president attended over the last week or so. And, you know, the whole goal here is just to provide something in the way of transparency about who was involved in these events and the way that this virus is spreading, since the administration seems reluctant to do so.
I should say and to tell you that we're actually supposedly working on a full episode of our show about data visualization, although I'm a little unclear still about how we're going to do that on the radio. But you're using that for this. And it seems... some people might say, well, why are you guys doing this? I mean, isn't there like a CDC or isn't there somebody who's supposed to be doing this for the American public? I know the answer to this question, but you should give it too.
Absolutely. We know the same answer. It's yes. And we wish we didn't need to do it. I'll state that, of course, we're not a formal contact tracing operation. We're aggregating publicly available information. But even so, it just illustrates the lack of caution and sort of care that some of the senior leadership has taken here. You know, there are reports that some people in the White House, staffers and certainly service workers, didn't find out about the exposure until 3 days afterwards in an email. That kind of thing at a workplace these days would be frowned upon. At the White House, it's pretty crazy.
Right. There's sort of an upstairs, downstairs element to this. And I noticed that you were linking to a piece in The Atlantic about this. I mean, we tend to know about and focus on some of the bold-faced names that might show up at a Rose Garden party. But there's like 400 people who work at the White House. A lot of them are valets and pastry chefs and stuff like that. And, you know, we don't know their names. They have families and they're right in the line of fire here.
Absolutely. And, you know, they're not going to be taken in a helicopter to Walter Reed anytime soon. So there is a sort of an upstairs downstairs element to this. And over and above the fact that there's a lot of people here that are personally at risk, it's, you know, this is a matter of pretty great national interest at the moment. So the idea that certain of these contacts that have very clearly been in close contact with people that have tested positive, you know, they get one negative test and then they go back out of quarantine, kind of flouting those CDC guidelines. And just yesterday, we had an example of the problems with that as Press Secretary McEnany tested positive after three, I believe, negative tests the preceding days. So people are not out of the woods yet, even if they, you know, attended that event at the Rose Garden for the Supreme Court nomination.
Right. I want to talk about several aspects of what you just said here, but let's just talk for a second about this. Are you pretty comfortable with the idea that the Rose Garden event and maybe the indoors reception that was attached to the Judge Barrett Rose Garden event is the kind of the originating event for this cluster?
Well, it's an interesting question. I think certainly the Rose Garden events, based on the information we have now, had the most people that have tested positive following that event in presence. So there's 10 positive cases that we've tracked to that event. Now, whether or not those cases originated at that event is almost impossible to say. Certainly there are some positives in the president's calendar that happened preceding that. But it does seem it's certainly the biggest event with the most sort of personal interaction. And as you mentioned, there are lots of photos now about how that outdoor event had a large indoor component, which doesn't help things at all.
And people at the outdoor event were doing things not only maskless, but hugging, kissing each other's cheeks. I mean, it does look like if you wanted to do some kind of public health chart showing what not to do, you see a lot of don'ts there. I'm also, I don't know how much of this you guys have done, and I know there's been some sort of crowdsourcing of this, but even kind of working backwards from President Trump's treatment protocol, given when the dexamethasone came in, which is kind of usually 7 to 8 days out, it kind of seems like the onset might have been right around the time of the Barrett party. I mean, it kind of makes sense that way. I'd like to ask you a little bit more about the crowdsourcing. Are people sort of coming forward to you and kind of saying, well, wait a minute, because I know this and I know that this person was at that event?
Yeah, so that's the way that we've gotten the majority of this information. You know, as I mentioned, my colleagues, Benji and Jesse, actually put together this spreadsheet, you know, just scrolling through Twitter, reading news articles, et cetera. And then we set up a little tip line as well. And since then, it's kind of been flooded with tips about various news articles or tweets or geotags from social platforms, et cetera. So I'd say that 85% of the information on there has been sort of crowdsourced.
So you get data, but then you have to be able to interpret data to make it useful. And so, I mean, one of the questions that you probably will be asked or have been asked is, based on what you know, should tomorrow night's vice presidential debate take place? Specifically, given what you know about the contacts that Mike Pence has had, should he be quarantining right now?
Look, I mean, if you are going to follow the CDC guidelines to the letter, the answer is definitely not. That debate should be held at, you know, on Zoom, if anything. You know, we've seen reports now, of course, that they're adding the plexiglass that was used in the South Carolina debate, as well as maybe a couple of other things. But I do think that the press secretary's experience here is illustrative. You know, you can test positive for this virus after receiving multiple negative tests. So, and certainly Vice President Pence was in close contact with multiple people that have now tested positive. So if this wasn't a debate or if this was a normal work setting, this event would have been moved.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of the plexiglass, and stuff like that. I liked what Saskia Popescu, an epidemiologist from Arizona who's been on the show a bunch of times, said. She said it's, you know, asking us to come up with stuff like that is like asking us to figure out how to drive drunk more safely. I mean, you just shouldn't drive if you're drunk. Don't ask us, you know, what kind of, you know, balloons to put in your car or something.
Yeah, absolutely. This isn't a, you know, a bigger seatbelt so that you can drive when you're intoxicated. Sesky is wonderful. We actually have worked together a little bit in the COVID tracking project. So I fully endorse whatever she has to say on the subject.
So, I mean, this will also, you've already sort of answered this question, but if the Rose Garden is the originating event, and if President Trump is 9 days out or something like that, and if, you know, Daniel Griffin, who does the, from ProHealth, who does a lot of the clinical briefings on This Week in Virology, he says patients can shed virus 20 days out. This whole question, and I realize you're doing data visualization and I'm asking you to make an epidemiological judgment, but this might affect the October 15th presidential debate too. I mean, it might not be the case that President Trump is a safe person to be around even as late as October 15th.
It certainly could. You know, thank you for the caveat there. Definitely not an epidemiologist, wouldn't want to paint myself as one. But the timelines do make that at least a little bit hazy, especially since, you know, beyond the president himself, whether or not he's recovered enough to attend that debate, there are certainly other people that would have to be involved in setting up the hall, doing the logistics, all of that things. And we've seen multiple reports of people who were involved in setting up the debate previously have come down with the coronavirus. You know, thankfully, not any of the Biden camp or anything like that, but there have been other staffers and service workers, which sort of reinforces the message that, you know, there are rules for people who have lesser jobs, and then there are rules for people in the administration, and those two sets of rules don't seem to be the same.
Are there people, and I'm thinking specifically Secret Service, like, by the way, what we will do is we will tweet out and put up Peter's team's COVID tracker, White House COVID tracker, on all social media that we have, or he's Peter J. Walker on Twitter. You can find this pretty easily there, too. It seems as though one permanently blind alley might be the Secret Service. So there's a lot of Secret Service agents who have a lot of exposure. And of course, we saw two of them in a hermetically sealed SUV with President Trump on Sunday. But my sense is the Secret Service ain't telling nobody nothing.
Yeah, that's definitely the sense that we're getting as well. And that applies, you know, certainly part of the reason that we put this together, I'd say probably one of the main reasons, is to inform the public about highly important infections with elected officials or other senior leaders, et cetera, while we're interested in making sure that we contact that we trace and sort of get a handle on infections with the Secret Service and the staff and everything like that. We don't want to name those people if they don't want to be named. You know, we want to make sure that we are keeping that information private if it needs to be. But there's certainly, you know, there's a lot of spread that's probably gone unnoticed to this point. You've seen multiple family members now. So people that were not in attendance at any of these events, but just, you know, had a family member who was, come down with the virus. So this isn't, it's not as though it's contained to the people at these events, as you might expect. It's, if it's a super spreading event, it spreads, and it can spread quite widely.
It's worth mentioning that you are filling a void, as we said at the beginning, that is of interest to people, authorities in Minnesota, authorities in Washington, D.C., authorities in New Jersey, where the Bedminster event was held. In all of these places, they've got people who were at the originating event, who may have had contact with somebody with COVID. In other words, I mean, these are cases where public officials in these places want to plan responsibly and react to what's happened. And I get the sense you are more of a source of this kind of information than anything else they're getting right now.
Well, in some cases, that's true. In some cases, not so much. So we do know that the state government of New Jersey has been in touch with people that were at the Bedminster fundraiser and has been doing contact tracing there. But I think your wider point stands. You know, the administration has not only neglected to do so, has frankly declined to do any sort of contact tracing from the White House itself. So at that point, you know, I guess this sort of crowdsourcing is the best that we can do for the moment.
So we've been talking to Peter J. Walker. This is a terrific thing that you're doing, and it really is pretty fascinating, and it's interesting to watch people. I really do recommend Peter's Twitter feed just because other people are kind of weighing in, and, for example, there's somebody giving a really good explanation of how it's possible, for example, that Kayleigh McEnany would have tested negative two or three times and then tested positive. And I guess that's got to be kind of the fun of it, too, is just watching people kind of take up the challenge here. So, Peter, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, real pleasure. No problem.
All right. So we're going to go out here in just a second. poor Cat Pastor. Cat Pastor's been working around the clock to record all of the fundraising pledge breaks and all kinds of stuff. And she's having a problem with the clock right now, which she never has, but it's attributable legitimately to exhaustion. So I think we're just about out here. But I do want to say some nice people are going to come on. I guess it's Frankie and Katie and talk to you about why you should support this show. Please do it. Do it during our hour. Mention our show in the comments when you do it, and we will be very, very grateful to you. So I hear some music. I think I could probably get out here. Thanks to Cat Pastor, Betsy Kaplan, and all of our guests, and we'll be back tomorrow.
Just giving myself whatever they ask. But without this single truth, it is only emptiness that I cast. A happiness that will not last. I'm not here for that.